Hello, and welcome to Crit Club, the podcast where four friends watch movies from the Criterion Channel streaming service that none of them have seen before, and then discuss them. I'm your host this week, I am Corey, and with me, as always, is Wizard Chris.
No, hello, everybody.
Angela.
Howdy.
And Peter.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining us this week. This week we're going to be talking about the Vietnam documentary film Hearts and Minds by Peter Davis that came out in 1974. Hearts and Minds was pretty controversial as it when it first came out. One of the interviewees, Walt Rostow, put a restraining order on the film and tried to delay it. Production companies didn't want to touch it. It was shown for a week in L.A. to qualify for the Academy Awards, which it did ultimately end up winning the Best Documentary for 1975. It received a Criterion release, and it is spine number 156. We're going to get into talking about it, but it really talks a lot about the Vietnam War. It's sort of created at the height of the controversy, sort of towards the tail end of the war itself. And yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting conversation, and I think I'm really excited to hear what everyone thinks about it. So,
Corey, why did you pick this movie?
Yeah, it's true.
Good question.
I picked this movie because I saw that it was controversial at the time, and I was kind of like, you know, what's controversial about this? Is this just a bunch of like, I mean, what's the other side of the controversy here? That you're just like pro-war and hate people and want people to
yeah,
die
people
and all that stuff. And
like napalm.
Yeah, really, you like napalm.
Really
you like killing kids.
Is that this film.
You didn't give enough sympathy to the baby killers? Like, and yeah, that's basically the same thing that I felt is if you're not on the side of this film, then you are a disgusting, horrible baby killer. So. There will be, I will put in a trigger warning.
Line in the sand.
Yeah, line in the sand here. I'll wait. I have lots to say. I'll wait, to get into it more. But I also did see that it was like one of Michael Moore's favorite films and it was a big influence on his style. And, I just thought that was, you know, I just thought that was interesting. And you can kind of like see that, you know, the inspiration for, you know, future Michael Moore's in this film. I will do, I guess, like a trigger warning. We're going to be talking about war atrocities, war crimes, all the stuff that goes with that. But yeah, so I have a lot to say, I think. But why don't we start with, Wizard, I know you're kind of chomping at the bit to talk about this. So why don't we start with
God.
You? What did you think of Hearts and Minds?
First of all, I trapped my partner in the shower yesterday, and just like jawed her ear off about Indochina and Vietnam and the war and everything for like an obscene amount of time. Like, I've been dying to talk about this episode. As listeners may know, I am Canadian, so I have a different relationship to the Vietnam War. Although I will say that a relative of mine is an American who came to Canada during the war because they did not want to go. They did not want to go murder babies or what have you in Vietnam. So I was moved by like sort of the engagement that the film had with the sort of let the draft dodgers come home movement. This movie is really great. It's a really, really moving, documentary. It is quite difficult to watch at times. What's funny is that so many of the images from this film, I feel like I've seen before. You know, like I feel like this is one of those, like we talk about the Vietnam War as like maybe the first war ever shown on TV and like the first one to really get like media coverage in a significant way. And so like I was thinking about that a lot while I was watching this film because I'm like, I have seen a lot of these images before, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of them are from either from combat photographers and stuff like that. Like, of course you've seen these images before.
He did not film everything that was shown here.
Sure, yeah.
There was like newsreels and other sources that were like edited in as well.
It's a great movie. It's a real like slice of the time. You know, it's funny to think there's so many parts of this that are crazy to watch, like in hindsight. I'm thinking in particular of the Vietnamese fella who is looking forward to Coca-Cola Vietnam and Bank of America Vietnam.
Right.
And he's just like, yeah, I mean, if we lose, that'll all go up in smoke, but I don't think that's gonna happen. Yeah, it's super thought-provoking. There's a lot to talk about, so I'll just keep it short. Like, it's super thought-provoking. There's a lot to talk about. Like, I didn't like every aspect of it. In particular, I really didn't enjoy the scene with the two Marines and the two Vietnamese sex workers. I understand.
Yeah, that was a strange moment.
And, like, I appreciate its realness, and I appreciate, you know, the veritas of it or whatever, but I also found it to be an exploitative kind of moment of, in particular, the sex workers, but of these two idiot GIs too. Like, I found that whole scene to be distasteful and very 70s. And so I didn't really enjoy that. But overall, the movie is very striking. I was on it from beginning to end. There's some really horrible, difficult images in here. And my absolute favorite part, I was just about to check out of the film when the credits started to roll. But the parade, this Veterans Day, or this Veterans Parade, or this like Welcome Home POW Parade, I forget exactly what it is. But this parade takes place at the end of the film during the credits, just as I'm about to like mentally check out. And the scene keeps going and the credits keep rolling, and we find that this Veterans Day parade is also being protested by veterans who are not getting benefits and who are trying to draw attention to like the anti-war movement and stuff like that. And that was a great scene. That for me, that was like, oh, this, like that, the, I was like, oh, this documentary is pretty good, it's okay. And then I saw that scene, I was like, oh, this is the whole movie. This is 1974, 1975 in a nutshell. That's crazy. This is great. Really excellent footage. A lot of really excellent footage. A lot of really tough stuff to deal with. Excellent movie. Lots of fun. Well, not fun, but you know.
Yes. Angela, did you get through Hearts and Minds?
Oh, I did. This is I did watch the whole thing. I mentioned on our group text that I was having a really hard time, especially at the sex worker section, because it was just so painful to watch these people be like such idiots. But I think the film, it was necessary. Like, how the United States treated Vietnam was like a full force attack on every level, sexually, intellectually, physically, the whole. And I think to ignore that part of it was to ignore a major part of the story, and also to eliminate a whole section of the story about women. So as uncomfortable as it was, and how I had to pause it like four different times, like the hickey part, the fact that it's just keeps rolling, the footage, like just when you think it will stop, it just keeps going. And that's actually a, you know, this is a masterpiece of documentary cinema. It is the height of its particular kind of documentary, which is sort of a voice of God sort of situation. And it's interesting to hear that Michael Moore was inspired by it, because I do see a lot of similarities, but the main huge difference that actually raises Michael Moore's work above this particular one, which is still a masterpiece, like hands down, is that Michael Moore does what's called self-referential documentary filmmaking, where he acknowledges his role as the filmmaker and that this is his perspective, and kind of talks about his intentions. That's what makes it self-referential. Whereas documentaries that don't acknowledge that the form itself is affecting the message, and it encourages people to just accept what is shown to them at face value, which in this case it feels right, because it's like taking the opposite of what the Americans are doing, like the opposite of like American propaganda, right? It's using the same form, but it's actually turning it against America. Right. So I was a big fan.
This was also accused of being propaganda as well by the right. So
yeah.
Sure.
But I wouldn't necessarily, like I've said, it's kind of like propaganda, but I think it heightens the message that he's using the same methods, like news, you know, the same kind of documentary filmmaking methods, the juxtaposition of two completely different scenes together to create a third message. Like there's that one part, oh God, where I think some high mucky muck was saying how like there was really no excuse for Vietnam, like saying that it was a big mistake. And then the next shot was like people applauding. And so, I mean, I can't say that I loved this movie. There was nothing fun about this movie. And it pains me a great deal, because I feel like we haven't learned, and that amazing credit sequence that you're talking about, Wizard, like, it basically to me says, we're just going to keep marching on this path. I mean, they're literally marching. And I don't feel like right now we're dealing with so many of these same issues. And the biggest thing that I keep coming back to is that we keep catching the same fucking hook every single time. Like, we're you know, fighting in Ukraine, we're fighting in, or we're supplying everything to Israel. And I don't know that we really need to be a police officer every single fucking time. Like, are we the country of the cops? And that's, you know, it's not a film you watch to feel good about being an American. And also, it's a hard fucking lens on what American identity actually is. And I felt physically sick through most of it. Mm-hmm. So thank you for picking it, Corey.
Sure. Yeah. Peter, how about you? What did you think of Hearts and Minds?
I'm right now like a 10 on this movie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's the Vietnam War. I think there's the history. I think there's the understanding as much as we can, which is very limited in terms of all that we can know and all that we can understand about the reasons for being there, how it unfolded, and everything else like that. There is all of that, and then there is this movie, and I think this movie is separate from that, right? Like, I'm looking at this movie as, like, what is this movie? Like, what is this film? Like, what is it trying to do? How is it trying to do it? You know, I think I've, especially over the past 10 years, gotten a lot more, and since I, you know, I guess my journalism career started, like, have gotten a lot more suspicious and skeptical of documentaries. They really, like, get my spider sense tingling. There's just a lot of, like, and not all of them, but, you know, the vast majority of them, you can feel the editor's hand on there. That you can feel, like, some sort of pull of manipulation to try to make you feel one way or the other. Sure. Of course, listeners, this is extremely real, extremely dramatic footage of absolutely horrendous things happening to people. And so there's just an undeniability that this is just a tragic, tragic, tragic sense of it. Not on the other hand, what do I want to say? Like, bar none. Like, that's full stop. Like, I'm not disagreeing with that in the slightest.
But having said
that, I'm also thinking about... No. I'm sorry. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that, like, that it made me... This film made me uncomfortable about how it was showing Vietnam, about how it was showing the Vietnamese people, like, while still agreeing with me about their plight and how this has affected their country. I still didn't get a sense about, well, you know, there are so, I mean, there was like 20 minutes about people being kidnapped by police and tortured and held in cages, like, I guess by their own police, but why? Who are those people? Who are those people acting within what? Like, what was the political situation there? Like, what was the circumstances that people on the ground were having beyond just the, I mean, not to underscore, not to, like, ignore the tragedies they were facing, but, like, I really, like, boy, this film, you know, again, was giving us a full contextual idea of America. But I really, it almost felt like using these people and their tragedies for to explain America rather than like highlighting these tragedies for their own sake. Like, I felt, which is a prerogative of a documentary trying to put forward a thesis and a stance and trying to get people on the side of that. I don't know. Yeah, I thought the production was, like, very interesting. And no, I'm not on a 10 with this movie. I think I just really am deeply skeptical of documentaries. Like, I don't like feeling told to think one way or think one belief. Like, I know Vietnam. I know all this history. It's absolutely fucking horrendous. But I still feel like this left me with a lot of, like, actually more questions about it. And I do feel like that there were nuances not explored. Mm-hmm.
Is some of that this is a contemporary documentary film where the primary audience who'd be watching it at the time was pretty well versed in Vietnam. I mean, it was very publicized. It was on TV all the time.
No,
like, most of people watching it will know. A lot of people are seeing this for the first time. I would argue that a lot of people watching this documentary would be hearing some of this stuff for the first time and have no real idea why America's in Vietnam.
We've gone through the 60s. Like, this is the mid 70s. We've been hearing a lot about, like, Vietnam for a while by the time this movie comes out.
I think there's a huge difference here between what Peter's saying and what what Corey's saying here is that, and I agree with Peter, that there is a certain amount of it's presented as if it's the full story, but it is not the full story. And so keep going, Peter.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I won't go on too much longer. I'm sorry. But like, cause again, I'm not trying to like disagree with anything of the moral outrage about the fucking genocide. Of course. It's more of like, there's a line of, I don't know. Sorry. What I mean to say is I think I agree with you, Corey, that they did know about this Vietnam. This movie does feel like a Michael Moore movie from 1974. I think in all of the ways I maybe don't like Michael Moore movies, of like it seems like a pep rally for like, we know you hate this. And maybe that's what, maybe that's helped me get it for it. Like, cause it felt like a pep rally of, we all know this is terrible. So here's a bunch of absolutely horrific fucking scenes so you can further believe that this is terrible, in a way that like felt a little exploitative of the people going through the terrible things. Not completely, not from A to B, A to Z. Also, how do you do this? Also, on the other side of my thinking, how do you fucking make a responsible, completely editorially comprehensive story about the Vietnam War?
I don't think that's what lastly, he's going for. Like, I don't think that was his objective.
Yeah, to me, well, I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. My like, what I'm saying is, it seemed like his objective was to rally his own troops of people doing this, and I don't respond to that well in documentaries. I don't respond to pep rally documentaries well. Like, okay. tell me things. Like, tell me facts about things in a way that you know. Let me finish this because it feels like I'm getting people upset with me. Like my thoughts on this, our last documentary we watched, Harlan County, USA, is a fucking, I think that was the last one we watched.
Oh, wait, no, Bloodlight and Bammy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. The first documentary we watched, Harlan County, USA, 2 years after Hearts and Minds came out, is a fucking incredible documentary. Harlan County, USA is a remarkable documentary. I thought about it a lot while watching Hearts and Minds, and it occurred to me that like it was able to be so effective. I thought it was able to be so effective and so roundly responsible in its storytelling because the scale of its story was so small. Because this was a small community, a small fight, like the borders, the boundaries were all pretty well defined. And I think a story like Vietnam, even if you've got an agenda, is a difficult one to wrap your hands around in a manner that's going to please everyone. This is a really, really slick movie. I'm really glad to have watched it. I'm sorry that I am so skeptical of documentaries. Corey, what did you think of this movie?
I don't think this movie was trying to be objective or editorial at all. I don't know. I love a good like controversy, and like a lot of times when I'm like picking out my movies, I like finding movies that are like controversial or like run to the director's careers or whatever and stuff. And so I think it's a big part of like what drew this to me. I was just like reading up on the movie, and like from the Wikipedia article, it talked about how there were various Vietnam War films that were made throughout the 60s and 70s, and they reflected a lot of like deep divisions and stuff. But like a lot of them were pro-war and vilified the anti-war protesters. Whereas this was one of the first to be produced to sort of push back on that. So if you're in the context of a milieu of, you know, president after president after president of the United States, like being so hawkish on like these types of wars, and then being filled with like all this like pro-war, pro-colonialism propaganda, I don't think there's anything wrong with creating your own movie to push your own agenda when you know that like all this other crap that you're hearing from the, you know, the hegemony is like wrong and immoral. So I don't fault them for having an editorial bent. I mean, I think that I also don't think that there's a need to give a good proper like stage to the pro-war, pro-colonialism side. Like, fuck you. They get to live. Well, hang on. They get to live. I thought that it was very effective, and I think that it was probably something that needed to get made, especially at the time. So, I don't know. I think that like a lot of the criticisms that it was like that it was even slanted or whatever. Like a lot of it, I mean, you have the general of what was Westmoreland's like rank? He was the United States Army of Chief of Staff.
The man in charge of Vietnam.
Yeah, he was in charge of the Vietnam War, and you're interviewing him. So it's like, it's not like you're ignoring the other side. Yeah, the guy who's literally there, and the best that he can say is like, oh, those people, they don't care about life. Like, so, like, I don't know. I feel like this, they gave him the time to talk, and like, the best, that's the best he can say. So
that was the third take, incidentally.
Yeah, right. He's like, no, I didn't say that right. And then he said, yeah, he just keeps saying it worse. Yeah, and yeah, I don't know. And yeah, that POW guy who like can't get through a little pep rally without spouting slurs and stuff about the people that he was killing. It's like, I don't know.
I want to come back around to that, because I did take issue with this dude, with how they presented this POW. We can come back around to that later.
Go ahead. I don't think there's like a linear thing that we need to talk about here.
Okay. Well, like, I mean, that in particular, and I think this like, obviously it's an anti-war documentary. Obviously it is coming at it from a certain point. And I think what the film is trying to do, especially with the story of, oh God, what's the POW? What's his name?
George Coker.
So this guy, like, I think if maybe the film had a little more, it was a little less 70s, it had a little more emotional, like if it were a little more emotionally invested in sort of the people that it's telling a story about, like, we would learn a little bit more about this guy. I did some reading on this guy. He was in Vietnam for like a bunch of years, being tortured and beaten and having a really terrible time. Now, you could, like, I, you know, slurs not cool, let it, like being pro-war is dumb, and that statement, like, he's like, oh, if they'd asked me to go back, I'd go back right away. I'm like, you're a fucking dumbass, dude, don't say that. But this dude obviously experienced a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. He's obviously experienced a lot of, let's say, molding by Eisenhower's military industrial complex, or who's president, Nixon, or maybe whoever was
them.
That's the important thing. And I guess Eisenhower was more against the military industrial complex. Anyways, this guy's obviously carrying a lot of pain. He's obviously like suffered a lot, and he obviously feels like he, like, all of that meant something. And I feel like the film really fails to make that point. And if it's not interested in making that point, that's fine. But then you've just got this caricature of a guy who's like so stupidly pro-war and pro-military that even after the army landed him in a Vietnam torture cell for however many years, he's still willing to go back. I wish we could have talked to him more and found out more, and maybe we wouldn't learn anything, you know, maybe this is where he's at, but like, I wish we could have learned more about this guy's experience, his story, and maybe, you know, we can come around to kind of understanding why this is where he's at with the people of Vietnam and the country of Vietnam. You know, for somebody to be like, Vietnam's a pretty place, but everyone there messes makes a mess of everything. This guy has only met people. This guy went to Vietnam to cause pain, and the only people he met there, like, either caused him pain or he hurt. So, like, it's just like, it's one of those things where, like, you hear somebody say something like that, and you're like, well, there's more to that statement than just this guy is, like, a dyed-in-the-wool racist monster. Yeah.
It's like you fly to Houston, Texas, and go to a wrestling match, and then you come back, and you're like, everyone in Texas is wrestling! It's like, well, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, but then you juxtapose him with, like, the Randy Floyd interview where, you know, I didn't know what to think about this guy at first. You know, he's just basically spends the first, like, because they sort of tell his story, go through his interview in sections throughout the movie. And I'm glad they did, because it ended up kind of, it felt like a thread that was sort of being pulled throughout the film of him, you know, basically like bragging about how good he is at his job, you know, flying, you know, as a bombardier pilot, like dropping bombs and all that stuff. And then when it, you know, really comes around to the end, he seems like he at least, you know, went through an arc of, you know, I guess some sort of like redemption or whatever, where he starts to realize like the horrors that he was committing, and basically saying, you know, if, you know, he starts thinking about it in terms of his own kids, and if like these things were happening to his own, you know, children and stuff, and he starts, you know, getting really emotionally upset and crying on film and all that stuff, thinking about the stuff that he did. So, yeah, I mean, you sort of have these like this juxtaposition of these two, you know, vets, you know, one unabashedly unrepentant and one seeming repentant.
That's the thing that's tough about the movie is that in the footage that it shows us all this footage. And the best thing that I can take away from it is, yo, Vietnam was messy. Ooh, messy situation. And for the film, it's a neat, pat, simple situation. And fuck colonialism, fuck American imperialism, fuck anti-communism and proxy wars to fight ideological battles in this or that place. But like it is too complex for this movie to really do it justice if you're purely...
Do you get the feeling, for me, the way I saw that this film needed to exist in this particular period of time is that it didn't seem like people really fully understood the violence that was happening on their behalf, right? And so Peter was talking about at some earlier about how he felt that some of the violence that was shown seemed a little unnecessary to him, or at least that he was very uncomfortable with how this was really the only perspective of the Vietnamese people. Did I get that wrong, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, that's not how I meant it. Maybe I said it more than I wanted to. No, I, gosh, I'm really doing a terrible job of stating my thoughts on this movie. And I do apologize for all of that. I feel like that's what's happening, I guess. But it's more so of like, yes, all of these tragedies are there and they're real. And I don't think that they were shown in a misleading light at all. I think it was difficult for me because that was all was shown. Like, I really think it all gets, and again, I didn't dislike this movie at all. Like, I think it wrapped up for me in like that poor woman who was trapped and kidnapped and like beaten and kept in a cage by like the police officers and were never, and I don't understand why. And I don't think the movie ever gives a reason or an attempt to understand why a Vietnamese police force would do this. All we have is this person who is a victim. And that's how I felt like the whole of these people were kind of used for this movie as victims, which is true. But I also think in the realm of respecting humans, I think it seemed sometimes to me that this population of people were used as evidence for this movie's thesis.
It didn't really give them a chance to be their whole story. They were just these representations, these symbols that ultimately were meant to benefit the United States people, like to get them to change their minds. So there's no actual real benefit to the people in their exploitation in this film.
Which, I mean, I agree with Corey. Like, this is a movie trying to make a point, and what's the quickest, most effective way you can make that point is you show that pain, right? Is you show that pain as baldly, as bald-faced as you can, and boy, fuck, yeah, absolutely. And maybe I'm coming at this from, like, you know, 40 years removed, 45, 50 years removed from this, with 50 years of media about Vietnam War to where I feel like I understand the tragedy, and I'm thinking about it far too, like, zoomed out. But yeah, Immanuel Kant, one of his constructions of categorical comparative was that treat people as the ends of themselves and not the means to the ends. And I worried sometimes that this movie treated the Vietnamese people as means to the ends.
Fucking Kant. Sure. He's always there. Something clever.
It's always a good podcast when you get to bring up Kant. I think, though, that, you know, there were probably a pretty large contingent of Americans who felt like Westmoreland, where, you know, these people don't care about anything. These people don't care about life. There's so many of them over there. Life is invaluable to them. Like, they have no value to life. And so showing someone who is, like, lamenting the loss of their home that has been turned into a crater, I mean, I think really can help, you know, humanize a lot of people that, you know, the government and the media have, you know, been going out of their way for a long time to dehumanize, like literally dehumanize and show that, you know, so yes.
And movie's favors, I really enjoyed I didn't really enjoy, but I really thought like the interviews with the people who lost their son, what was his name? Chip, Bip, Blip. Sorry, that's nice. Very disrespectful.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'll cut myself out of that. But like this, who lost their son in the Vietnam War of Like, I thought that was humanizing for them as well in its own way, you know, that I thought was like an olive branch of sorts that this movie was trying to send out. Mm. Like, you understood why these people, they didn't want their son to die for nothing or to die for this thing. I don't know. There was like something mm-hmm. really raw about that that I did, I guess, appreciate is the word.
I'm going to...
That scene where, you know, where they did say, you know, these people clearly don't value life. And then the next shot is us like bombing a bunch of shit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I really liked how that conveyed, you know, who are the people who actually don't value life? It's us. You know, we don't value life. We value commerce, territory, and exploitation, as actually evidenced within this own film, because even our critiques of this situation, employ a certain level of exploitation. Can we not escape it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And to get, you know, first year film student about it, like, is this movie not about victims of the Vietnam War? Like, mm-hmm. period. Like, yeah. Everyone in this film, is their relationship to Vietnam is being exploited. Like, we have our returned POW. We have the people of Vietnam. I agree that some people are presented as victims, but like, they also talk to the guy who ran Vietnam for about 30 seconds, has the tapes of the U.S. government being like, yeah, man, why don't you get out of Dodge? Why don't you? Yeah, we would like that. He's like, I kept the tape. And yeah, you're like, fuck yeah, man, keep the tape.
Yeah.
The priest, he had a great line. He was, what did he say? He said, the government says that, or he says, everyone doing good is a communist, or the government says mm-hmm. that everyone who is doing good is a communist. So he says, I guess that makes me a communist too, or something like that. So like the movie doesn't explain it, but these people are talking about the US-backed South Vietnamese government, which is super dictatorial and super oppressive and basically cracking down on resistance and dissidents because they're trying to win a war. That's not justifying it. That's just, I'm sure that's what they would say if you asked them at the time. And man, like, so for me, the thing that I'm still struggling with the idea that people seeing this movie have a full picture of Vietnam. Like, it's one thing to protest the war. It's one thing to say, hey, we shouldn't be over there. It's one thing to see footage of, like, villages being blown up and stuff like that. But, like, this footage of, like, this Vietnamese man being like, that's where my sister got blown up. This is the crater where my house used to be. Like, these are things that I don't think people have seen. Yeah. Or like Westmoreland sitting down and being like, well, this is kind of the thought I had. And at one point he has that line. He's like, oh, this other general came to me and he's like, oh, there's going to be lots of opportunities in Vietnam, but also disaster or something like that. Like, yeah. Like, there's so much in this film that I think, and I think, Peter, you touched on it. I think that we are coming at this from 40 years since Vietnam, and like the ability that we are accustomed to the American government being a colonial power. We are accustomed to generals being psychopathic shitheads. Like, we're accustomed to learning the side of a story. We're accustomed to learning the side of the story of the people who are victims of war, in this case, the people of Vietnam. But I think, as a film, if we're talking about this as a film, I think that this is bringing new shit. New shit has come to light. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes to light in this film. And again, there are issues with the presentation. Like, the sex worker thing really bothers me because, like, it does nothing. It does nothing. You know what? It is all there for that line at the end. My girl back home would freak out if she saw me now. Yeah. That's all it exists for. And like, you know, maybe we can look at this and be like, oh, look, this is colonialism. These are American dudes being shitheads in a foreign country and they're going to go home and pretend none of this ever happened. That's a good takeaway. And that's kind of my takeaway. But, you know, I don't think that lesson necessarily justifies, again, what I found to be like really exploitative. Like, not like it was there for titillation in a movie that is supposed to be quite serious. They sit down with the architects of the Vietnam War and are like, hey, that was all bullshit, right? And then they juxtapose that with like some fucking idiots, like some college kids on war vacation.
Like, was that titillating, though? I was not titillated. I was horrified.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
There's boobs there, but, like these women, generally speaking, like, if the war wasn't happening, this might not be happening in this way. And just the cavalier way in which they discuss these women and take away their agency, even as they're intimately connected with them in situ, it's terrifying. Like, I have bile in my throat just thinking about it right now. It is so gross.
Yeah, and I think it...
And,
sorry, go ahead.
And yet, I think... Like, I think it, if it wasn't in the film, it would be taking away a major part of the notion of the raping of this entire culture.
And I think that, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it was just kind of showing what shitheels Americans are. And,
yeah.
You know, and, like, there were so many, there were a number of scenes that were shot, like, in the country, and the soldiers, you know, I know this was a thing, especially when the draft was going on and stuff, and, like, the soldiers just kind of kept getting younger and younger. But there's some of those scenes where those kids, like, they're like 18 years old and they look like, you know, high school students, you know, little 6-foot high school students with a fucking flamethrower burning people's homes down and stuff. And so it made me just feel this whole, like, just ickiness about everything, about America's behavior.
When I finished the movie, I asked Laura, and this is a serious thing that I like. Some academic somewhere, listeners, find your friend who does weird academics and pick this up. Were mustaches popular in the 70s because there was a generation of American men who had blown somebody up but couldn't grow proper facial hair? And so at 18, they're like, I'm going to grow a mustache because I think I'll look like an adult. Also, I blew somebody up. Just something to think about. Where do these trends come from? People wore beards until Alexander the Great shaved his. Why do we do anything? So, Americans, shitheels, sure. Colonialism, shitheels. I'd like, this is about an American war, but this movie is at its best when it shows that this is kind of how this operates. This is the game, this is the playbook for colonialist wars everywhere. Like, the French, I'm sure, were doing the exact same thing in the 30s and 40s before they got booted out. Like, they were also being like, oh man, my girl back in Marseille is going to be crazy when she hears what I did over in Vietnam.
Well, and they have Daniel Ellsberg, interviewed here, who I don't think they even state in there, but this is the guy that released the Pentagon Papers.
They don't mention he works for the Rand Corporation, which they really should.
I mean, not for very long, if that's true. I guess he would have released it, you know, by now, and he was charged with espionage and stuff for releasing these papers that, yeah, like they explained here, that just, you know, show decades and decades and president after president of basically just lying and lying and lying and lying for all of the reasons for any of our involvement in Indochina and stuff. And I don't know.
even Indochina is a shitty colonialist word.
That's true.
Because it's about the space that exists between the places that that colonialists care about more than other places. Where the movie succeeds as a critique or as a sort of like a tapestry of imperial and colonial operations within smaller countries, I think the movie does a great job.
Yeah, and I like your point of this movie sort of bringing some new stuff to the table. Where it's, yes, I think it's Peter that said that Vietnam was sort of the first war to be televised. Where
it was Wizards did that.
What's that?
Wizards of that.
So if I'm wrong, blame
no, me. That's no. I remember learning about that in history class, about how there were just these horrible war images that were like shown on the, you know, nightly news and stuff. And then, like, once this conflict ended, that was not a norm anymore. You know, what it shifted from sort of showing very sort of personal, hurt and all that stuff to like far zoomed out bombings and stuff, maybe, or like some, you know, night vision stuff that, you know, of buildings getting bombed or whatever. The up close and personal nature of the coverage that was happening with Vietnam seemed very unique with this conflict. But I do think that a lot of the stuff that this was showing, you know, the interviews with people who had, you know, had their house destroyed, the, you know, the tours of like the prosthetic, you know, place, the guy who's just making like 900 coffins a week and stuff. Like, I bet this was probably a lot of newer stuff where you just kind of get to, you know, it's one thing to just sort of, it's almost like showing the sort of mundane, like everyday horrors of the war that I don't think were actually, you know, being, you know, a cause. I mean, it's one thing for like someone to be murdered in an instant, and then it's another thing to like, wow, we have to build a whole lot more prosthetics because a lot more people are getting fucked up from this war and stuff. And like, it's just, I bet that that was probably a pretty interesting and unique perspective, or at least like coverage that wasn't being covered very much when this came out.
That kid's story about accidentally getting napalmed by his own side and like using another soldier as a as a shield from napalm. Fuck, man.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Like, that guy died in like 2014. He became a psychologist and worked at, I think, a VA hospital and had like five different grandkids.
The guy who took a bullet, he was like, oh, I was super jazzed about killing people, and then I got shot and paralyzed. He also became a veterans rights activist and an anti-war activist. Like, there's so many fascinating stories that the movie put. Like, all of this is fascinating material, and you know, there is still, despite all of that, despite all of these incredible images, all this really incredible material, I feel like, even to, like, talking about it, I feel more deeply that sense of discomfort that Peter described, just because. Like, I understand that the movie wants me to think that war is bad, and I agree with the premise of the film, but I come away with this, like, this sense of like seeing some stuff that I wasn't supposed to see, if that makes sense. I don't know. And that's dumb, and I think naive, or like a desire to keep certain things out of your head. I don't know exactly, but I do feel this sense of like this voyeurism, I guess. That's the word. I feel this like not entirely okay sense of voyeurism about the movie.
Yeah, but I mean it may be flawed, but I think that it was still a lot more humanization of Vietnamese people in this movie was being done in any other like media source back when this was being, you know, filmed.
I haven't seen any other contemporary documentaries like contemporary to this of Vietnam, but I'm sure that very few of them ask a single Vietnamese person, hey, what how was this for you?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I mean, does anybody have any other thoughts about this?
I'm actually legit nauseous and don't want to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
I'm really sorry. I'm sad. Like, I'm sad mainly because this country hasn't really changed a whole lot. And it's been 40 years and we haven't learned anything. And this film, for all of its exploitiveness, it did attempt to make people feel like what we've lost actually as Americans, and what the Vietnamese have lost, and that we were responsible for it. And I don't feel that bad that I feel bad, because I should feel fucking far worse, honestly. But I don't know that I can talk about it anymore. I'm sorry.
I don't think we have learned a lot. There was the one guy that was, I don't know what his name was. I just wrote capitalist shit heel. In my notes, is the guy who's just like sitting there like waiting for peacetime so he can make a killing, you know, in the marketplace,
America, Vietnam,
all that stuff.
And
he admits he's a war profiteer and all that, and I'm just like, man, this guy would fit perfectly into modern times, like, because if anything, like that type of attitude is just like more and more accepted, you know. Money rules all. So well, we can move to the ratings if people are
well, I mean, I would like to bring up some things, but I don't.
No, bring it up, Peter.
Yeah, bring
Jesus.
It up.
I don't know.
Is it
okay?
Yeah, of course it's okay.
It's welcome, okay. In fact.
All right.
Otherwise, it sits.
No, I mean, I feel like the more I agree with a movie like this, I think the more I agree with a documentary, I think maybe the more skeptical I get about it. I think that's probably something that happens to me when it comes to, and so I think it was like, I think I'm zooming in on like the cracks that I found in this movie more than I should be. And it's like, because, you know, Angela, you talking about like us not learning anything and American sort of foreign policy being so different. Like, how do I even begin to say this? So I've I read, I guess in January, Eichmann in Jerusalem, Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem, and I read another history book about the World War II and the Holocaust. And sort of the immediate aftermath around that. And, you know, and I've got a history degree. And I've read, you know, too much about a lot of this stuff. And, you know, it was one of those things of it's almost worse that it's almost worse now in terms of foreign policy because at least, and again, please know that I'm not at all ever defending colonialism or anything else like this. Please, God, never. It's interesting to think at that time, after World War II and the expanding, you know, Soviet Russia, of like, it almost seems like there you can see the reasoning to want to not to invade Vietnam, but the reasoning to like, you know, who knows when the is this going to be another Reich? Is this going to be another, you know, like all-encompassing totalitarian threat? Because that's what they believed, at least through the 50s.
Sure.
You know, when our involvement with Vietnam began, I guess, in 55, 54, 56 or something. And it's like that is something that I feel like I can historically, pragmatically, rationally understand.
Yeah.
Like these not people, an invasion, not yeah. anything else like that. Like you just get rid of this conflict that fucking destroyed the world and this emerging other huge threat, whether, you know, how much of a threat or not, who can say. But like this involvement, this beginning involvement, like there's some part of me that's like, I see the international rationale of like states, you know, of like international relations in this way. And it's stuff like that where like that was something I thought about with Hearts and Minds watching, like, man, I really wish I would have had more like it just knew what it was doing in a way that like it's just banging on the keys in a way that like, I guess, I don't know. Whatever. Like I agree with Corey that this was for people who, I guess I have no point. Whatever. Good movie. Yeah.
I don't think it's unrealistic to say that people immediately in the aftermath of World War II were already preparing for the next war. So yeah. like especially when there's already obvious sides like staked out, right? Like there's already an obvious like ideological conflict coming. There's obviously a war coming, or like it feels like there ought to be.
I genuinely thought that was fascinating at the beginning of like those I guess that musical number of like the soldiers marching on those treadmills.
Shit, man.
Like so like that was some real like you all aren't seeing the irony of just defeating the fascists and then having this. Mm-hmm. You do realize this is the exact same thing, mm-hmm. just with different colors. And so like it was something like that I found myself attached to. But I don't know. I think overall, I'll stop talking. I do think this is like a pretty unique film. Like I can't imagine the time it came out and the things it shows. Like I do agree with Wizard about like, man, some of this nuance, like I'm really not sure that a lot of this was as accessible to people. Well, it wasn't. It only ran for like a week, right? And so, I mean, like this was something that was still hard to find.
I think so. I'm actually not sure what the full release was. It ran for a week in order, like in 1974 to at the tail end of 1974 in order to qualify for the Oscars, but I'm not sure if it got a larger release.
Yeah, it's a fascinatingly unique and, like, I think probably a pretty special film just in terms of when and where and what it's trying to do. And I do think, like, my concerns are, like, from a vast remove that, like, even, you know, how do you make a movie that has all of those respectful considerations in such a messy, messy situation?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How do you make a movie about war that doesn't, or how do you make even a film about suffering? Like we encountered this when we watched Abel Ferrara's vampire film.
I thought about that too.
Which the name escapes me. The addiction.
Yeah.
We ran up against the same thing where a movie wants you to think about death and suffering and pain by exposing you to real death and suffering and pain, and you know you respond to it, but there's a part of your brain that's like, hang on a second. Yeah. What are you, director of film, trying to do to me by showing me this?
And I think that was a little bit more. That was a little bit more nefarious because 100%. It was a vampire movie.
Yeah, because it was a heroin allegory with Christopher Walken.
But I agree. I did think about that movie within that context of this as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you.
I mean, I'm in awe of directors, whether they be Ari Acker or documentary filmmakers, where like you can elicit an emotion out of me. I mean, it is something we should be skeptical about. Yes, especially when it's a documentary and it's like purporting to show truth. But
and that's that shit. I should be less sensitive about it. I should be less sensitive about it. But I'm always like, what do you want me to feel? And should I be feeling that? And if I see it more closely that you really want me to feel this thing, then I'm more skeptical. Of course, it's like if it's fucking kids being burned by napalm, that is black and white. I agree with you about that. But it's like, but you know, it's just like there are a lot of these sort of ancillary shots and scenes in there that are just like, I don't know if I should trust everything that I'm being shown.
I think a certain level of skepticism is healthy, very healthy. one of the other things that I actually didn't realize when I was watching this movie is like that I guess there was a lot of people in America that thought like, hey, we won, we did it, like, and there, it almost made me think of like
not
the,
but yeah,
it almost made me think of the George Bush on the aircraft carrier with like mission accomplished like 20 years before the conflict in Afghanistan ended.
That's why this movie works so well as a film about imperialism and colonialism, because it is the same playbook. This movie could be about any power at any point in history. It is always the same thing. This is war. This is taking territory. This is stealing things that don't belong to you. Like, this is endlessly the playbook. And I don't think we've ever gotten off this tip. I think this is how it happens every single time we get involved, and we, as meaning humanity, like all of us collectively, this is how we get drawn into these stupid misadventures. Mm-hmm. Every time.
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and then get to ratings. On this show, we rate things a little differently than most other places. We go from 1 to 20 as a nod to the 20-sided die from Dungeons & Dragons and other role-playing games. Wizard, do you want to get us started off? How would you rate?
Yeah, fuck it. Let's do it. This is challenging. This is such a naughty ball of a movie in so many ways. I'm still on board, I think, to give it a 17. I think it's very effective. I think it's a great story about how we keep doing the same dumb shit. And what that's always looked like, and what that will probably always look like. Some problems, but we've kind of gone over those, and like it was.
Are you comfortable with it?
It was something.
You have until the end of the episode
something
to
that
change,
I'd recommend
as we saw last
folks
week.
See. 17.
Angela, how would you rate Hearts and Minds?
I'm gonna give it a solid. I'm gonna go with Wizard on a 17. I thought that it's a masterpiece, right, of what it is for that time. But in retrospect, I agree with Peter in terms of like it doesn't really acknowledge its own place in how their own message can color how they're presenting the truth. And even if I agree with everything that they're saying, just as in, you know, if I'm comparing all documentaries, it's still very highly rated, mm-hmm. Just not perfect.
Sure. Peter, how about you? How would you rate Hearts and Minds?
Yeah, I'll go 15 on this one. Like, I think it's an extremely unique and notable film in history, in American history, and cinema as well. I think, yeah, we didn't talk too much about like it as a documentary in place of like the history of documentaries, but I feel like this had to be some sort of like large turning point or early, at least flashpoint milestone in what that form, that artistic form looks like. And I'm so excited to have seen it. And I think all my, not all, but some of my issues is some of the issues that we talk about a lot in the show about basically bringing, you know, 2024 standards to, you know, old movies. Mm-hmm. And especially with something as complicated as this. I think that's not a reason, I think, to go lower than that. So yeah, 15 is really, thank you for this, Corey. This was really, really interesting.
Sure. And
what about you? How do you rate it?
And I promise I already had this number in my mind before you and before Wizard and Angela rated it, but I'm also going to give it a 17. I think that, yeah, overall it's very good. It's not without its issues, but I really enjoyed it. And it's probably going to be one that like sticks with me for a little while.
It was definitely going to stick with me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what did you, listener, think of this movie or any movies that we've watched or discussed on here? You can always reach out to us. We're on various things, Instagram, Threads, whatnot, at Crit Club Podcast, or you can also email us. CritClubPodcast@gmail.com. And also, let us know what you think about next week's movie, which if we could, before we get to this, so on the Criterion subreddit, someone did a bunch of like data analysis about various Criterion releases and stuff. And there was all sorts of different things that they were analyzing. But like one of them was, you know, what is the most common like decade of film, and what's the most common like countries that they all came from and stuff. And they were like, it was overwhelmingly like 60s and 70s were where Criterion releases are from. And it was obviously United States was number one, and then I think France was number two of films that came out. So it made me think about what Peter's pick is going to be, because I think it slots right into that.
Yeah, it's my pick. And for once, listeners, I come before you with not as much trepidation. This isn't The Shout. This isn't The Hour of the Wolf. This is not even How to Get Ahead in Advertising that I bring before you. I think I've stumbled upon a vein that it seems like other Crit Clubbers as well as me have not seen, and also a lot of them are my big blind spots that I've wanted to watch for a long time. So probably for the next few releases that I pick, we're going to dive deep into the heart of the French New Wave. And the first one will be The 400 Blows, François Truffaut's directorial debut in 1959 coming-of-age drama film. And I kind of know very little about it, except that I should have watched it years and years and years ago. So I'm not going to say more because I don't know anymore, and I kind of don't want to learn anymore about this 1959 French New Wave coming-of-age drama film. The only thing I do require for some validation is for Angela to let me know how excited you are that I am picking a 1959 French dramatic coming-of-age film.
Magnifique.
I'm excited
too. Just a crazy sight.
I'm excited too, Peter. Like, as I'm the same. This is a big blind spot with me. This is I have not seen any really of these movies from this movement. So I'm excited to dive in, and I'm also happy to watch numerous of them as well. If you want to pick more,
for sure. I mean, I forget I've even asked, but I'll put it on the production. I don't give a shit. Like Breathless. Has anyone seen Breathless?
Yeah. I have not seen Breathless, but it used to be a big joke when I was in college. Like, oh, were you in the class where they showed Breathless? There was just always like a thing about Breathless that I still don't understand 20 years later.
Well, Wizard ruined it, so you'll have
it's
to find
great.
It.
It's a great movie. All right, it's a really great movie. Recommend.
Regardless, The 400 Blows is what we'll be watching next week, and I would love for people to watch it along with us.
Very good. And if you do watch it along with us, you can reach out to us, CritClubPodcast@gmail.com. That is the end of the main part of the podcast, but we do always like to talk about what else each of us is watching. So, Wizard, what else you've been watching lately?
Oh, this is a tricky one. I don't think I've been consuming all that much movie or television lately. I am enjoying Baldur's Gate 3. I have also just gotten into Helldivers 2, which I'm already like, yeah, this is great. Let's just kill robots and zombie or robots and bugs and fight for freedom and democracy. Yeah, that's going to be great. I'm going to keep it there. Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. I'm gaming. I'm gaming and working.
What else you've been watching, Angela?
Ooh, oh yeah, I saw Drive Away Dolls, the new Ethan Coen movie, I don't think there's another movie more suited to Corey, honestly, in terms of pacing and tightness. I haven't seen a movie this tight in editing in many, many years, and it was super fun, unexpected, and I laughed a lot. I don't know that Corey is the target audience, it was just a fun romp, and I hear that they're going to make more. So super big recommend there. And then
more as in like sequels or more?
The team is going to make not necessarily sequels, but similarly genred films because Ethan's partner is queer and wants to make more queer films. And they're also polyamorous, which is awesome. And so, yeah, we're going to see more of that. And I welcome it because I mean, this makes the third film in a row that I've seen in theaters that has satisfied at a very high level, Perfect Days, Drive Away Dolls, Poor Things. I feel like I've hit a renaissance in cinema that I didn't see coming. And next week I'll be seeing Dune 2.
I'll see you there. Really looking forward to.
So excited about that. Yeah, looking forward to that. But then at home, I have gotten back into the South Korean soap operas again.
Nice.
And cool. Netflix has Captivating the King, which is made by the same people who did like 100 Days My Prince. And there's this whole thing, like this is the second South Korean soap opera I've watched where like the main female character is forced to dress as a guy for like 10 or 11 episodes. And it just makes things very like unintentionally queer in some ways, and I am just completely riveted. I had to pull myself away from watching another episode to record this evening, and that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my evening, is like probably another 3 episodes. It's different because I don't know all the stories or the context. There's a lot of historical and political intrigue. The good times, that's what I'm watching.
Very nice. Peter, how about you? What else have you been watching?
Not a ton, but I did the Criterion Collection, or the Criterion Channel, put out this collection, which I almost picked one from this, it's been, what is it? It's just March 1st now, and it's been a real Jonathan Glazer-inspired year, because I feel like I started off with Zone of Interest, and I've been kind of thinking about that movie nonstop, but they put out a Jonathan Glazer collection, and so I rewatched Sexy Beast.
I was thinking about watching that.
Have you not seen it?
I have not seen Sexy Beast.
Oh, you'll
love
it.
Have you seen Sexy Beast?
So good.
Fuck me. Looks great. I assumed that everyone. No, I don't think I've seen it since like the mid 2000s or something.
I saw it in the theater. It was so good.
That movie is fucking incredible. That movie is like still like, I think it came out in 2000, and I think it suffers from a tiny bit of like late 90s style addiction. Like there's like, you know, you watch it now and it's like you see shades of Guy Ritchie of like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
One of my things has the exact same. I'll talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, but like all of that is completely fucking forgivable in this extremely fascinating deconstruction of a heist movie. Like no other heist movie has existed that is like this. Like very few characters match whatever Ben Kingsley is doing. Like this fucking movie like is a goddamn masterpiece. Like this is like 18-19 on the Crit Club scale for me.
Wow.
Like rewatching it was like so eminently engrossingly watchable. Also, an hour and 27 fucking minutes. Mm-hmm. Like right. You're good. You're doing great.
Keep it tight.
Like,
thank you.
Fucking it's like one of those movies that like I've always had such a high memory of it, and you watch it again and it still holds up that exact same. That's a great fucking feeling. Cool. So Jesus, yeah, Corey,
I'm gonna watch Sexy Beast. I'm looking
into do it. It's
Jesus,
good.
Y'all, like that is a fucking solid goddamn movie. I'll leave it there for now.
Right on. Well, yeah,
Corey, what else are you watching?
One of mine has that sort of same like late 90s, early 2000s sheen to it. As I mentioned before, Frida is really going through the entire oeuvre of Jodie Foster, watching all 49, I believe, of her movies. I'm only dipping in and out on certain ones, but one of the ones we watch, Panic Room. I'd never seen Panic Room.
Oh, Jesus.
Never seen it.
Fincher,
that gave
right?
me
yeah,
panic attacks.
That's a David
attack.
Fincher, yeah.
Yeah, David Fincher, yeah. And it has a lot of that sort of same feel to it, but great movie.
Is it? I remember it being like just kind of mediocre.
Nah.
Just kind of like, all right. Like not.
I really liked it. I mean, as far as like just one of those like trapped movies where you're just like stuck, like I thought it was just really, it was just bam, 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 action, clever, I don't know. Wasn't perfect, but like I was watching it, I'm like, yes, this would be an 18 or something like that for me. I really enjoyed it. I just missed it on the first time around. We watched a number of stinkers from Jodie. Hotel New Hampshire is one of the worst movies that either of us have ever seen, based on John Irving novel. Have you seen it?
Oh boy,
I love John Irving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wretched movie. John Irving is just a kind of a flowery worded edgelord for like boomers. And that's this movie like in spades. Not much to talk about. Also like Five Corners with Tim Robbins, which was like okay. I got a little bored. But the one I really want to talk about is Catch Fire / Backtrack. So this is a Dennis Hopper directed movie. And I'm gonna like spoil some stuff on it, but this is kind of at the end of the episode. So if you want to have this movie, it's worth it because I really want people to like watch this. So it has this amazing all-star cast for a movie that is ultimately a like USA Network, like up all night, like schlock, horrible, terrible B movie. But I mean, it's got like Jodie Foster, Charlie Sheen, Joe Pesci, Catherine Keener, Vincent Price. It stars Dennis Hopper as well. It has a cameo from Bob Dylan. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And it is so bad. It would be incredibly boring if this was a nobody cast, but like watching this cast do this like low level of terribleness. So the pitch that Dennis Hopper gave to two, I believe, female writers is, and this is going to sound horrible, write me a movie where the main character falls in love with her rapist. That's the movie that he wanted to tell. And so he hired these two writers to write this movie, and it is fucking terrible. Like, it is just a complete train wreck the whole way through. So I'm surprised, honestly, having watched this, that this movie is not talked about more in the pantheon of bad movies. So anyway. And it got two titles. It was released under Catch Fire. And then he did a director's cut, which added 18 minutes. And then retitled it Backtrack, I guess, because he had originally taken his name off the original cut and credited to Alan Smithy and stuff. But I don't know how what he added, he felt improved at all. It just kind of shows that like Dennis Hopper is a bit unhinged and maybe it's just a little bit like as mentally unwell as the characters he so often portrays. Anyway, that was Backtrack. And
Oh, I didn't know if that was all your films.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that's also the end of the episode.
Oh, wait, I forgot one film. Is it okay if I share it? Guys, you may not have known that I had actually not seriously watched Showgirls and finally watched it.
Oh, hooray.
Speaking of...
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Oh, it's worth it.
It's worth it. It really is.
Yeah. It's a seedy little movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were talking a few weeks ago about cinematic portrayals of psychopaths.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I feel like I finally understood that watching this film. And you don't realize
fucking sexy beast Ben Kingsley and sexy
that too,
beast.
Right? Yeah,
I mean, you're talking about like the character of Nomi or like someone else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nomi is crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
She's a very particular kind of crazy that I don't feel like any other thing has really captured in that way.
Lightning in a bottle, people. Yeah. Lightning in a bottle.
I'm never gonna look at a pool the same way again.
No, go.
So slushy. Such a slushy pool. I'd also just like to very quickly express regret that the four of us won't be able to watch the 1980 Al Pacino gay serial killer thriller Cruising from William Friedkin, because I've seen it. It's hilarious. Oh, yeah, it's so bad. Definitely worth checking out for Pacino's hair and just tone deaf, weird ass examination of queer lifestyle.
Yeah. No, I remember that being just a wretched movie.
Super fun.
But hopefully you did not think that this was a wretched episode. Thank you everyone for joining us, and we will see you next week when Peter, we will be watching, what is it again?
François Truffaut's The 400 Blows.
That rhymes. You're a poet. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
It does rhyme.
Bye.
Bye.